This is Audible.
Pies and Prejudice, written and read by Stuart McConey. A few years ago, I was standing in my kitchen rustling up a Sunday brunch for some very hungover, very northern mates who were down for the weekend. One of them was helping me out, finding essential ingredients like paracetamol and orange juice, and asked me, "Where are the sun-dried tomatoes?" "They're next to the cappuccino maker," I replied. A ghastly, pregnant silence fell. Slowly, we turned to meet each other's gaze. We didn't say anything. We didn't need to. Each read the other's unspoken thought. We had changed. We had become the kind of people who rustled up brunch on Sundays, who passed round sections of the Sunday papers and popped down to little bakeries, the kind of people who had sun-dried tomatoes and cappuccino makers. Southerners, I suppose. I don't like thinking this way, like a Pict in an animal pelt, face blue with woad. I'd rather be cosmopolitan, suave, displaying an easy confidence with pesto and fish knives in the Hammersmith and City Line. I have tried to change, really I have. I say lunch, I say book with an not an ooh, although I do draw the line at supper and bath. But then again, I do have a cappuccino maker and sun-dried tomatoes. Actually, moving with the times, of course, it's now some sun-blush tomatoes, so much juicier, don't you think? Lovely, tossed with a little balsamic and feta. But on some level, I feel it should be a plate of tripe and a pound of lard, the sort of food you want after a hard day digging coal from a 3-foot seam or riveting steel plates. Proper jobs, in fact, as opposed to tapping effeminately at a keyboard for hours on end or talking to yourself in a radio studio. This book, then, is an attempt to rediscover both the North itself and my own inner northerner. Does the North still exist? Are the hand-wringing cultural theorists right when they talk of a Britain of identikit prefab towns, each with a body shop, Costa Coffee and Waterstones? Or is the North more likely to rejoice in a flagship Cash Converters than a flagship Harvey Nicks, whatever the fashionistas of Leeds might think? The North. What is it? Where is it? Where does it begin and end? What does it mean to be northern? And why, in a country that you could drop and easily lose in one of the American Great Lakes, does that 2.5-hour journey from London to Manchester or Leeds still feel like crossing time zones, political borders, and linguistic and cultural frontiers? The BBC has no South of England correspondent. I say this without malice or anger. I wouldn't want you to think that I'm eaten up with corrosive rage over it or that I'm making my way to Broadcasting House with a flaming brand even as we speak. It's just a fact of nature, like glaciers or osmosis. The BBC has no South of England correspondent because there isn't a South in the same way that there's a North. If there were a cohesive thing called the South of England, you'd expect to hear some swelling music in the back of your mind, Vera Lynn singing the White Cliffs of Dover, perhaps, or one of the Wurzels' agricultural ditties, and to feel some unifying emotion. But none is forthcoming. This is because there's no conception of the South comparable to the North. Good or bad, the North means something to all English people wherever they hail from. To people from London, cheery costermonger, cravatted fop, or Shoreditch-based web designer on stupid scooter alike, it means desolation, arctic temperatures, mushy peas, a cultural wasteland with limited shopping opportunities populated by aggressive trolls. To northerners, it means home, truth, beauty, valour, romance, warm and characterful people, real beer and decent chip shops. We like to think we're different. But what makes us different? What shapes us? Well, we like to think that some of the forces are elemental. The North-South divide was illustrated by a trog cartoon in The Observer published during Thatcher's mid-80s pomp. Two smartly dressed yuppies are drinking champagne under a cloudless southern sky, while at the other side of the frame, a dour middle-aged couple, rain-sodden beneath glowering clouds, are complaining, "They've got their Prime Minister, why can't we have ours?" Crucially here, the difference between them is not just political or economic, it's climatic. There's not much point me regaling you with statistics like Leeds being drier than Barcelona, or Cornwall being wetter than Manchester, or Sheffield summers being generally warmer than Newquays, true though these all are apparently. What matters is perception, and when we think of Brighton, we think of nudists going gently pink. When we think of Devon, we think of cream teas in the garden. And when we think of Sunderland, we think of a man with the rime clinging to his beard, leaning into a hail-peppered gale in May. The writer and TV producer, Judith Holder, has written that it's not that we get worse weather in the north, we just sort of get, well, more weather. Winds that take slates off in the night, or have you asking someone two doors down for your dustbin back. Frosts that send old ladies skittling along pavements and kids mincing gingerly onto duck ponds, despite what those scary public information films say. We relish our weather up north, and we relish our capacity to endure it, as much as we deride the softness of southerners in this regard. When a Cornish village gets flooded and a state of emergency is declared, we tut in sympathy, but secretly we think, what do you expect? You live on the beach. And after looking at the TV pictures, conclude that they wouldn't cancel the racing at Thirsk for that drop of rain. Weather carves the landscape to a degree. Rain and wind scour and groove the hills through waves of ice ages, green the fields, smooth the coastline. Millennia of freeze-thaw scatter splintered boulders in valleys gouged by the tides of ice. Not for us the soft, feminine allure of downs and wolds, the rolling pasture, the chalky uplands. No, the north is built from Skidder slate and Borrowdale volcanics, granite and limestone. All of this, we think, makes us harder, flintier, steelier. We are the ones who turn the air conditioning down in the meeting room, who want to sit outside the pub in October, who order the hottest curries, the strongest beer, the most powerful drugs. We like to think we're different, and we cherish our prejudices. But we can overcome these prejudices. When the resolutely northern pop group the House Martins transformed themselves in the mid-80s, they chose the new name The Beautiful South. Pretty much everyone thought this was a heavily ironic choice, to be said with a sneer. The Sunday Times simply assumed that it was a sarcastic dig at England's north-south divide. In fact, singer Paul Heaton chose the name because it sounded nice, like a film. And there are lots of things about the south of England that sound nice to me. There's the music of Vaughan Williams, with its heady scents of warm Gloucestershire afternoons, or The Clash, whose music is full of the even headier scents found beneath flyovers in West London. There's Powell and Pressburger's dreamlike films, such as A Canterbury Tale, where Kent becomes a mythic Avalon. I like Cornish pasties and M.R. James ghost stories and Dorset Blue Vinny cheese. But none of these things say the South in the same way that certain things, good or bad, true or false, whippet or flat cap, say the North. What would that mythical BBC South of England correspondent be like? Bertie Wooster? Wurzel Gummidge? Mike Runaround Reed? Prince Charles? What would he wear? A straw boater? Jodhpurs? A sheepskin jacket? Beef-eater garb? The BBC does have a North of England correspondent, and he conforms very much to type. He, and it always is he, is one of their more lived-in presenters. A stocky man in his early 50s with jowls, a florid complexion, and a bullishly heterosexual moustache. He looks tough, but somehow defeated. Maybe an old rugby league pro with a messy, financially punishing divorce behind him and the beginnings of a drink problem. I suspect there may be a quarter of Bells in the pocket of that Gore-Tex anorak. Fiona, in the nice warm London studio, will go over live to him, but where exactly is he? To many a south-based viewer, I guess he's in that vague but colourful region, up north. Up north is a long way away. You wouldn't want to go there. According to legend, the north begins at the RAC traffic centre on the M6, just at the point where the road surface changes from tarmac to cobbles. Michael Winner believes that the north begins at Oxford Circus. "Anything north of Oxford Street is just ridiculous," he once said, probably with his mouth full of a rare and cruel pâté made from otters. According to a posting on the Late and Orient website, the north begins at Barnet. Absurd, but of course, if you think Leighton is the Orient, you evidently have Mark Thatcher's sense of direction. It's more common, axiomatic in fact, to say that the north begins at the Watford Gap. Not, note, north of Watford, used incorrectly by residents of Fulham, accompanied by a wave of the hand, means bad restaurants, restricted shopping, spears, wolves and woad. But it's a modern misnomer. The Watford gap has nothing to do with the nondescript Hertfordshire town whose football team is beloved of Elton John. No, this Watford is a little village in Northamptonshire, on the B5385 just outside Daventry. Its famous gap is not a branch of that American place that sells chinos, but a low pass through the gentle Northamptonshire hills that's been used by the Romans, the first canal and railway engineers, and more latterly, the M1. Watling Street, now the A5, runs through it. So does the West Coast Main Line Railway and the Grand Union Canal. For years, this was the traditional crossing point between the Midlands and the South East, and hence, by extension, the gateway to the North, as far as Londoners were concerned. There used to be a well-known coaching inn here, actually called the Watford Gap, but you'd be hard-pushed to get a pint there now. It was boarded up the last time I looked. Instead, travellers going with heavy heart to London, or with light step to the North, can get a skinny decaf latte and a jaw-droppingly expensive pasty at the nearby Watford Gap service station, located on the M1 between junctions 16 and 17, and mildly celebrated as the first motorway service station in the UK. Motorway catering may begin here, but as far as I'm concerned, the North certainly doesn't. Northampton, despite its name, is not the North. It may not be exactly the South, but it is undoubtedly, well, Midlands-ish. The UK edition of the popular Lonely Planet travel guidebooks posits that the North begins in the Derbyshire Dales, somewhere around Bakewell, home of Britain's most celebrated tart. Now, there may be some truth in this. Hereabouts, the soft chalkiness of southern England starts to stiffen with grit and limestone. There are proper ridges, escarpments, and big, bleak, brawny moors. The grit is philosophical as well as conceptual. On Kinder Scout, in April 1932, hundreds of ramblers willfully trespassed to reclaim ancient rights of way onto the mountain, a hugely significant event commemorated in song by Ewan McCall and Chumbawamba. It should be said, though, that most of the trespassers came from Manchester. Head a little further north and a little further west, and you reach the debatable lands of Staffordshire, perhaps England's most enigmatic county. It has pottery and a bull terrier. It has its own local delicacy, the oat cake, a sort of heavy-duty tortilla with the texture of flannel, which excited clayheads get all tearful about, and is actually pretty good with cheese and bacon. Burslem, along with Stoke, Longton, Hanley and Tunstall, is one of the five towns which make up what's thought of as Stoke-on-Trent. Say this in the pubs of Fenton, though, town number 6, and you might get your head kicked in by local geography casuals, should they exist. From my experience of the denizens of Stoke-on-Trent, largely gleaned by the unscientific procedure of studying who gets on and off the train there as I pass through en route to Manchester, it would seem that the people of the area need little encouragement to turn nasty. I always feel quietly relieved when we get to Macclesfield. But for all the funny foods and simmering aggression, I'm still not having it that Staffordshire is the North. For one thing, the football teams aren't good enough. Sorry, but it's true. And its sing-song accent is undeniably of a Midlands lilt. But go a little further north, and you reach the spot where I would say the North undeniably begins. Though it's in a very classy and grand county, it's far from classy and grand. It's an iconic structure, though, although it isn't architecturally impressive or visually striking. For homecoming Northerners, it is the first sign that they are back in the right place, their moral and cultural compass righted. For Southrons heading up country, it's here that the realisation begins that you may be in a foreign country, as the vowels flatten and the skies grow leaden and the track curves away from you to the hills and moors and chimneys of the North. Welcome to Crewe Station. Please make sure you have all your belongings with you before leaving the train. Balham may be gateway to the South, an actual Southern Railway advertisement from 1926, later a legendary Peter Sellers sketch, but Crewe is surely the gateway to the North. It's from here that you head on to Manchester and Liverpool, the Lake District, Lancashire, the Pennines, Yorkshire and the bracing coast. Making sure I have all my personal belongings with me, I detrain, as the current lingo has it, to find that the station is somewhat underwhelming, given its enormous strategic importance as a communication centre and the hub of the British Rail network. Maybe it's just too busy to ponce about turning itself into a heritage site, but it's a shame that it's not as imposing as Grand Central or King's Cross. It's just as important. The Lemon Tree Cafe seems to be doing well, though, and I note, with a little ah, that two students are cuddled up fast asleep on rucksacks in the waiting room. If they do get round to a refurb, that would make a nice little statue, sweetly emblematic of Crewe. Jonathan Glancy, the architectural writer, has spoken glowingly of Crewe's heritage, of it being one of the world's great workshops, building Rolls-Royce and Bentley cars, as well as building the fine locomotives that sped expresses northward from Euston and south from Glasgow, Edinburgh, Liverpool and Manchester, all of them pausing for water, tea and buns at Crewe. He talks of a town bursting with civic pride, with workers' educational initiatives in every library and church hall, a true community that would have stayed a happily sustainable one if the railways hadn't been privatised a century on. At Christmas 2005, the timing of these things is always immaculate, don't you think? The company that owns what remains of Crewe Works announced that a third of the 1,000 people still working there would be made redundant. At its peak, Crewe Works employed 20,000. Soon that figure will have dwindled to zero. It's the same old song with a bitter little refrain that you hear again and again in the blighted industrial towns of the north. But away with such gloom and into Crewe, gateway to the north. Out of the station onto a confusingly anonymous bridge that gives no clue to where the actual town might be. Turning left at random, I immediately find that I am on Gresty Road, which, as anyone who spent swathes of their life poring over Rothman's football yearbooks or glued to grandstand will tell you, is home to the exotically named Crewe Alexandra Football Club, and what must be the most easily accessible football ground in England. A piece of venerable graffiti on a low wall claims, Dario Gradi is God. Now, in case you think Crewe has a special affection for Italian film directors or left-wing playwrights, let me explain. Milanese by birth, Dario Gradi was, as of 2006, the longest-serving manager in the Football League, arriving at the club in 1983, when Betamax was still slugging it out with VHS, and digital music for computers meant Gary Newman. In an industry that's become synonymous with venal greed and posturing, Gradi was renowned for nurturing young talent and for his good humour and loyalty. In Crewe, there's a street named after him, Dario Gradi Close, as well as a band, Dario G, who had a handbag house hit in 1997 with Sunshine. He has the freedom of the borough and probably never needs to buy a pint in South Cheshire ever again. Out of Gresty Road, I'm lured left by a sign on a lamppost that promises, excitingly, the Nantwich Road Shopping Mile. This would seem to be mainly of interest to people shopping for kebabs and Bacardi breezes. I've never seen so many pubs and takeaways. The Station Hotel, oddly the focus for a recent novel by Alexis Sale, has rooms for £25 a night, and you might need them if you sampled the sundry wares of the Nantwich Road Shopping Mile. The Barrel is offering 2-for-1s on premium lagers, free birthday drinks and cut-price pitchers. Feeling peckish myself, I decide to try something a little more traditional. Goodwin's Chip Shop is, like George Orwell's mythical pub The Moon Underwater, the sort of place you feared no longer existed. As well as the chippy bit with the glass counter and the battered sausages and cod in neat glistening rows and the red-hot metal strip perfect for burning your forehead on, there's an adjoining cafe section. This has tables and those glass sugar servers that miraculously pour just one teaspoon when you tilt them. There are red leather booklets with menus inside. There are nice pine chairs and tables, a kiddies menu, cans of Vimto and jam roly-poly for afters. There are ketchup dispensers in the form of those comedically outsized plastic tomatoes that always have a congealed bit of red on the nozzle. Elsie and Hazel, behind the counter, encourage me in the direction of the lunchtime special. Fish, chips, mushy peas, mug of tea or soft drink, 2 rounds of bread and butter, £4. I take a seat, feeling absurdly, childishly happy about having fish and chips for dinner in Crewe on a crisp February afternoon. And it was my dinner, not my lunch. Gordon Gekko in Wall Street sneered that lunch was for wimps, but it would have been more accurate to say that lunch is for southerners. Up north, we have our dinner in the middle of the day and our tea at night. A little defiantly, my Scouse agent and I will still talk about going out for our tea, even if we're dining somewhere dreadfully shishy in the West End, which we don't do, obviously. And don't get me started on supper. A TV producer once invited me round for supper, and I was genuinely flummoxed. Supper means something very specific in the north. and I was rather bemused by the prospect of going round to her house in Chiswick at 10:30 at night in my dressing gown to have digestive biscuits and cheese off my lap on the settee while watching the telly. Dave Goodwin, eponymous proprietor of the fine chippy where I had my dinner, is from London, but has lived everywhere and is now domiciled in Winsford, a town some 7 miles away, built on the salt industry. After 17 years loyal service, he was made redundant by Littlewoods and the next day joined BHS. After 7 years, they made him redundant too. So I thought I'd buy a chippy. After consulting the maps, drawing circles with compasses and scrutinising the competition, he bought this one, a great big gleaming place on Crewe's Nantwich Road, a thoroughfare apparently famous among Crewe's hungry revellers. "There are 41 takeaways on this street," he said. "Didn't you notice? Fish and chips are dying out. There'll always be some people who love their fish supper and won't have anything else, but the glory days are gone." I can remember those glory days well. When I was a little kid in Wigan, seemingly everyone went to the chippy on a Friday night. I'm not sure why this was. Maybe it was something to do with being flush with the week's wages, or not being bothered to cook if you were going out on the town, or maybe because the Catholic Church forbade meat on Fridays, but took a pretty relaxed attitude to cod, plaice and whiting. Whatever the reason, the Friday night chippy run was a ritual. They queued on the pavement outside. Some took bowls with them, the sort you might put on a child's head to help with a cheap haircut, and asked for them to be filled with chips, which they'd then take home, covered with a tea towel. We didn't do this, because my mum thought it was common. But as for Crewe, I didn't come here just to have a good feed. I came to find out whether, as I contend, Crewe is really the North. By one fabled criteria, it certainly is. Namely, the friendliness of the locals and their use of affectionate terms. Within 20 minutes of arriving, I have been loved by several women. Several more have petted me, lovered me, one or two even lovied me. Mainly, it has to be said, by ladies of a certain age, but twice by women in their 20s, which hopefully proves that this great northern tradition is not dying out. If you're not used to being talked to in this way, it can be a little disconcerting at first, but it's also utterly delightful. And if you want to be really disconcerted, go to Sheffield or Rotherham, where even brawny men will address you as love. But what did Dave and Elsie and Hazel think? Is Crewe the North? Dave says yes, emphatically. Hazel says no, it's the middle, and goes on to explain, a little obliquely, "On the farm where I grew up, there's a tree, and that's in the middle of the Cheshire Plain. We are in the middle of England, between the hills and the sea." And then when Dave's back is turned, she chuckles to me conspiratorially. "It is the North, really. I'm just saying that to wind him up." Implying that the subject is hotly debated every day in this cracking little chip shop. Back on the Nantwich Road, I decide to test Dave's claim by counting all the takeaways. I give up at 21, though, as my head is spinning with Bombay Gardens and kebab lands and Thai palaces. My favourite, though, is Full Bellies, which has a kind of winning vulgarity, don't you think? Armed with some directions to the town centre, blink and you'll miss it, I head off down Eddleston Road. Eddleston Road may have less of a flavour of the souk about it, but it's an entertaining stroll up a classically northern street. There are back-to-backs, as well as posh double-fronteds. Plus there's an array of quirky entrepreneurial ventures. A sex shop coyly offering marital aids. Snaky Jake's, custom amplification since 1971. Picnic basket quality sandwiches and A1 trophies, the sort of little shop selling tiny snooker cups and wooden shields that you often find in northern back streets and whose continued existence is both mystifying and heartening. There are a number of hairdressers with the now compulsory punning titles, the best of which is Style Council and the worst, Hair Today, Fade Tomorrow, which doesn't exactly sound like a ringing endorsement. The unexpected appearance in the midst of all this of a Polish delicatessen reflects the town's large and fast-growing population of workers from Eastern Europe. Many have been here since World War II, but thousands more have come in search of work after Poland's accession to the European community in 2004. Now, Poles comprise 6% of Crewe's population. According to a Polish proverb, home is wherever you find your bread. Well, you can find your bread at Grodzini's, as well as your kielbasa and golabki, your poppy seed cake and borscht. As warned, I don't blink, and so I find the town centre. Apparently, this is due to be demolished and rebuilt soon. The locals I spoke to were very keen on this. About bloody time, too, I saw, said an old man with a sticky bun in the bus station cafe. But I thought Crewe Town Centre had a rather pleasant 1930s air about it. There's an imposing clock tower in a vaguely modernist architectural style that I can't name, although I have to say I'm always a little disappointed when a bus station dominates a town centre. At night, though, it must be a great place to drink your own body weight in Smirnoff ice. Most days in the broadsheets, Hampstead-based cultural commentators can be found bemoaning the homogenisation of our towns. When they do, they always cite the prevalence of McDonald's, probably because it's a soft American target and it's the first thing to pop into their head. From my travels, though, there are two far more inescapable icons that are the ubiquitous emblems of modern Britain. Greggs and the high-visibility tabard. Crewe has a Greggs, and like every other Greggs in the UK, it was rammed. Greggs' tasty home-baked fare has become synonymous with that other contemporary phenomenon, the chav, a tasteless, pallid, Burberry-wearing, jewellery-encrusted prole, usually found as freakish exhibits on mid-morning TV after they've married their probation officer's mum or some such. While, like every other clear-headed Marxist analyst, I bemoan the fact that the working class has become enfeebled in this way, I do also detect a pungent strain of good, old-fashioned snobbery in the middle-class demonisation of the chav. Also, I quite like Greg's pasties. You wouldn't want to live off them, but after a night on the Bacardi Breezers, I'd certainly prefer one of their chicken and mushroom jobs to a rocket and shaved parmesan salad. Everyone knows about Greg's. The high-visibility tabard, though, now the unofficial uniform of all British working men and women, is something of a personal obsession. Once upon a time, these luminescent lime-yellow plastic creations were only sported by AA men, rail track maintenance men and lollipop ladies, people who genuinely had to A, stand in the pissing rain for hours and B, be quite visible. Now everyone wears them. Doctors, novelists, priests. They're like the leggings and baseball cap of the 21st century. And don't tell me that, strictly speaking, a lot of them are actually jackets rather than tabards. I can bang on about that for 20 minutes with the following wind. Cheshire fantasy writer Alan Garner once described Crewe as the ultimate reality. I'm not entirely sure what he meant by this, but I don't think it's complimentary. But get this. Crewe has a crater named after it on Mars, approximately 3 kilometres in diameter, located at 25 degrees south, 10 degrees west. Beat that, Hampstead! The sun comes out as I stroll by the Lyceum Theatre, and I spot with some pleasure the library, a neat municipal building in that same 30s vernacular as the rest of Crewe's town centre. Public libraries in the afternoon attract a certain kind of melancholic misfit whom life, it seems, has somehow passed by. I don't know if this is a good description of me, but I do like a nice public library of an afternoon. Crewe's was all quiet British busyness. Fresh-faced students with reading lists and businessmen returning their Andy McNabs and John Grishams, as well as the more conventional, even caricatured, daytime library clientele. For instance, two men who clearly rendezvous here every day. One wears a 70s bobble hat, the other has an absurdly long beard way beyond common sense, like those Indian blokes who are always trying to get into the Guinness Book of Records. They are discussing the raging toothache one of them is suffering from, but this doesn't stop him eulogising, in a stage whisper, a new range of linseed bread in the local Tesco. I stroll idly through the local studies section, hoping to learn more about the town. Forgoing all you need to know about H2O, the story of Crewe's water supply and branch lines, I take a red folder down marked Crewe, a town of lost opportunities, compiled by Harry Jones. It's really just a collection of cuttings relating to the thwarted possibility of a transport museum in the town, culled from 50 years of the local papers. But it's also a sonata of quiet rage. Having chronicled and lambasted the half-century-long short-sightedness of the local council, Harry seethes by way of conclusion. By contrast, the photographs at the back of this folder show what one town, with foresight and imagination, can achieve. Swindon. This is surely the most glowing tribute that that particular Wiltshire town has ever received. As is always the way when you look through old newspapers, I quickly lose interest in the stuff I'm supposed to be reading and am drawn to those incidental stories elsewhere on the page. Methodist Queen Yvonne is crowned, and the brilliant Bath's car park plan, total lunacy. As I leave, Beard and Bobblehat are discussing the opening hours of the new Morrisons and the massive robbery from the Securitas depot in Kent that's dominating the news pages. It's the biggest in British history. They got greedy. That was their downfall, Bobblehat explains sagely, with the great worldly wisdom of a man who spends all his afternoons in a public library in Crewe. Back at the station, you can glimpse in their natural habitat another kind of British male, often thought of as melancholic and misfitted to the world, the train spotter. I try to engage one in conversation, but clearly he is elsewhere, his rapt face shining with pleasure and concentration as he studies the distant platforms for his quarry. You can understand it. For devotees of train spotting, Crewe Station must be a kind of Mecca, their Valhalla, their Nirvana, their, well, Crewe, I suppose. If Jeremy Clarkson were here, he would doubtless be pointing out in that plonking way of his that these individuals are sad. Well, how come? Trainspotting doesn't appeal to me one bit, but then neither does Jeremy Clarkson. How come if you're tragically obsessed with vile, globe-destroying penis substitutes, you get the nickname Petrolhead, but if you like trains, you're an anorak? Petrolhead sounds sexy, you have to admit. It says something about the world that if you're an enthusiast for anything, if you dare lose your ironic modern detachment and world weariness, you become sad and a loser. As the Pendolino swings gently out of Britain's rail cathedral, you can see that Cheshire, damp and flat and green, is a dairy county. Old sayings still survive, like, in wet weather, a cow has five mouths. Bizarre at first, and indeed second hearing, it means that each of the cow's feet destroy the sodden grass and ruin it for other grazers. Remember that. It may well win you an admiring audience from older drinkers in Knutsford or Nantwich. As well as milk, Cheshire has salt in its veins. They've been mining it here since the vast beds were accidentally discovered in early Victorian times. And still each year, enough salt is extracted from the Winsford mines to fill Wembley Stadium to the brim, pitch, terraces and all. Glance at any map of the county and you'll find it dotted with witches, denoting brine springs. One of them is Northwich, home to my favourite British football derby. Northwich is not a big place, but it has two decent non-league football sides, Witton Albion and Northwich Victoria, and the rivalry between them is ridiculously intense. A half-decent gob would carry from Witton's ground to the Drill Field where Northwich play, and yet the rancorous schism divides the town to the bafflement of outsiders. 15 minutes train journey across those flat dairylands of South Cheshire, and soon comes along seven giant cooling towers and a cluster of chimneys with plumes of white smoke. At nearby Ellesmere Port stands the colossal Stanlow Refinery at the end of a 15-mile pipeline from the Tranmere plant on the Mersey. At the height of the 80s industrial romanticism, local boys' orchestral manoeuvres in the dark wrote a song about it called Stanlow, a dreamy ballad awash with synthetic strings and harps. My mate John's dad, who had worked there, listened to it with a suspicious look and said, "It doesn't sound much like bloody Stanlow to me." Disembarking at Bank Quay Station, you can smell the pear drops tang in the dusk, just as you used to be hit by the earthy scent of hops from the Boddington's brewery when you pulled into Manchester Victoria. The lever plant looms over the platforms, and the early evening air seems to be full of ether and sodium. Warrington is notoriously hard to pin down. These days it's the largest town in Cheshire, being absorbed by that county in 1974, although traditionally it was in Lancashire. It certainly feels Lancastrian, built on heavy industry from steel to beer to wire-making. The town stands on the muddy banks of the Manchester Ship Canal, and they take their rugby league very seriously round here. The gap, no, make that a chasm between the two codes of rugby, is one of the great north-south divides. On the one hand, there's Union, a game for ruffians played by gentlemen, and on the other, there's League, tough as teak, as northern as hot pot and Yorkshire pudding, as the absurd Eddie Waring once said. Or to quote Michael Hurd of the Evening Standard, a sport that Londoners don't give a toss for, a game for ape-like creatures watched by gloomy men in cloth caps. As far as most Northerners see it, union was invented when a public schoolboy, too stupid and unskilled to play football properly, picked up the ball and ran off with it like a girl. They may allow professionalism now and not have to reach for the smelling salts whenever money is mentioned, but in essence it's still a game for the middle classes. The southern middle classes, to boot. League, I contend, is the vastly superior code. Faster, harder, infinitely more skillful. The ball is actually passed at speed from one player to another, rather than merely hoofed skyward and then bundled upon en masse on its snow-flecked return to earth. Until relatively recently, union almost prided itself on its lack of application, fitness and rigour, on what it treasured as its amateur status. Indeed, as my old friend the comedy performer Neil Ashurst would say, the only good thing about rugby union is that it's always nice to see policemen and barristers getting knocked about a bit on their day off. Rugby league is a proud sport, proud of its working class lineage, proud of its family values, a phrase which actually has some meaning here. If you ever went to a Wigan and Warrington game in the late 70s, or a Good Friday Humberside derby, you'll have learned firsthand from the dodging of flying bricks that rugby league has not always been hooligan-free, despite what it cosily likes to think. But these were brief aberrations in what has generally been a game watched and played in the very best of spirits. A man's game where women and children have always been made welcome and secure on the terraces. In his book on rugby league, To Jerusalem and Back, Simon Kellner recounts a wonderful story of the 1982 Challenge Cup final in Leeds, where, in a crowd of 44,000 people, there was just one arrest for drunkenness and outside the ground. Kellner recalls how, on that day, the only minor incident he witnessed was a mild fracas when a Hull supporter, dressed in a black and white kit and wearing a stripy top hat, tried to push into a taxi queue. He was insisting that he was the Minister for Sport. As you leave Bank Quay Station, one of the very first signs you see promises directions to the Cultural Quarter, not a particularly northern notion, certainly one that would be chortled at in the Chelsea Arts Club. Naturally, I set off in the gathering dusk with a spring in my step. When I soon encounter another sign pointing back the way I have come and also bearing the legend, the Cultural Quarter, I realise I have walked through the quarter without noticing. Disappointing. Perhaps I'm being unfair. Perhaps it was unrealistic to expect bearded bohemians setting up easels by the dry cleaners or men in berets playing atonal jazz saxophone on the town hall steps, but I had expected something more. So I go back and I have another look. The Pyramid Arts Centre, focus of the Cultural Quarter, is closing as I arrive at 5 p.m, which must make it rather less than useful for Warringtonians with day jobs. And there are plenty. Warrington has one of Britain's lowest unemployment rates, with a booming high-tech sector. A pity. I would have liked to look at an exhibition or two, or maybe have caught Warrington's improvised music collective, back with, and I quote, their blend of Balinese and Javanese gamelan for multiple guitars, a celebration of the ancient Japanese form for electronics, and an evocation of the interwar serialism of Schoenberg and Webern with live electronics. And you thought it was all brass bands, didn't you? In 1973, Warrington Town Centre was pretty much razed to the ground in an orgy of planning. The result is a city centre that is positively crowded with a hodgepodge of development, huddling and looming everywhere, towering above you and blocking out the sky. It feels a bit like a central European market town circa 1500. But with a Greggs and a Superdrug, of course. Peter Andre is appearing soon at the Chicago Rock Café. Evidently, Warrington Rock Café was thought too literal. And there are real ales at the Friar Penketh. A blackboard outside the Postern Gate pub reads, "Your fun starts and ends here," which is meant to sound alluring, but actually comes across as faintly threatening. If you're peckish, you can eat at Cromwell's, just as Oliver Cromwell himself did when the town was much smaller and the site of a decisive civil war encounter. Bridge Street runs through the centre of town and plays host to a pretty rum selection of street sculpture. A sort of water trough dribbles onto a partly submerged cupola covered with little handprints. I couldn't see a name, but I bet it was called Zeitgeist 5, or Resolution. There are also some big sticks that light up for a purpose I couldn't fathom. At the very top of the street are 10 outsized translucent green tent pegs. It turns out that these are the 10 guardians of Warrington, representing the people of the town over 200 years. Representing them fairly obliquely, I'd say, but quite nice. It's nearly dark as I head back down Bridge Street en route to the railway station, but my eye is caught by a plaque in front of Boots. Right by the sign offering one-third off selected fragrances is a simple black marble oval set in granite. On it is a picture of a smiling young boy and a toddler and an inscription that reads, "In remembrance of Jonathan Ball and Tim Parry, 20th of March, 1993. I had forgotten that Warrington was one of the last British cities to be bombed by the IRA. It followed a bomb attack a few weeks earlier on a gas storage plant, which caused major damage, but no casualties. The second attack killed these two children and injured many other people. The bombs were hidden in cast iron litter bins outside Boots and Argos and wreaked havoc among shoppers on a fine spring afternoon the day before Mother's Day. 3-year-old Jonathan Ball died while buying a card. These attacks were the work of the Provisional IRA, a pointless, brutal assault on a northern working-class town. Even those people who'd sometimes sympathised with the aims of the Republican movement were confused and despairing. As it turned out, it was one of the final and most horrifying and absurd acts of that whole Irish tragedy. Other fears, threats and bogeymen were alive in the British psyche in the late winter of 2006 as I walked through the chilly dusk back to the railway station. And with newer anxieties to keep us busy, many of us may have forgotten the Warrington bombs. Warrington hasn't. So if Crewe is the gateway to the north, and Warrington the first big, proper, indisputably northern town, then Cheshire is where the north begins. The mild frontier, complete with grazing cows and footballers' wives, rather than buffalo and squaws. We may be up north now, but there are parts of Cheshire where the Incomes and the wine bars and the 4x4s make Islington look like Ancoats. We'll be visiting there a little later, in search of the posh north. But I've got a long, long overdue return visit somewhere else first. Home, soft lad. For some people, going back to their place of birth must be really special. For instance, if you were born high atop a lofty Cairngorm peak, or in a box at the Royal Albert Hall, or, for some reason, in the penguin enclosure at Dudley Zoo. Or maybe like Tom Waits, who, legend has it, was born in the back of a New York taxi while stopped at some lights. I was born in the big, modern maternity unit of Wiston Hospital. For me, the only really interesting thing about my place of birth is that it was not in Wigan. That's where I grew up, an almost comically northern town, and that's another story. But due to a thrilling quirk of fate that my mother has never adequately explained, I entered this life many miles away, over the border, in a strange and foreign land. Though everything about me, my views on sport, my taste in food, my accent, marks me out as a dyed-in-the-wool Lancastrian, I am, in truth, something else entirely. A double agent, a spy, a foundling, a mystery man, a Scouser. Well, sort of. Wiston is located 1.5 miles south of Prescott, 3/4 of a mile east of Highton, 4 miles southwest of St Helens, and 1.5 miles west of Rain Hill. Prescott, you see, lies in the hotly disputed, semi-legendary borderland between what Scousers see as the primitive rural wastes of Lancashire, a dully undulating hinterland of chimneys, whippets and flat caps, and the bracing, lively, dynamic metropolis of Liverpool, with its irresistible humour, joie de vivre and catchy tunes. If I'd been born those 10 or so miles in another direction from Wigan, over into Oldham, say, or Bolton, or even Manchester, it wouldn't have mattered. But I was born in the Tijuana of Lancashire, the Kashmir, the Korean demilitarised zone, where two mutually uncomprehending cultures clash and trade insults in their native tongues. In the language of the Scouser, people from Wigan, and for that matter Bolton, or Oldham, or Bury, are woollybacks. In fact, I tend to think that woollyback is really just an imperious racial generalisation. I think most Scousers secretly think of both the Milanese fashion designer and the Bantu tribesman as woollybacks, united in their tragic non-Scouseness. If you want to be specific, though, Woollyback means those sooty Lancashire textile towns to the east and north of Liverpool. Wigan is the crucible of all things Woollyback. As for the derivation of the term, well, if it ever crops up on Mastermind, I'm sure the explanation given will be, as it often is in polite circles, that the term originated in the cotton industry, which once dominated the whole county when traders from the Lancashire towns used to carry the cotton on their back to sell in Liverpool. The Scousers, it seems, mistook cotton for wool. I have long suspected that the real reason is that Scousers believe that in their isolated rural state, the average Lancastrian of an evening seeks solace in unnatural congress with his ovine flock. I could be wrong, though. Most of the time, this schism is acknowledged with good humour. For a few years, I worked in a town called Skelmersdale while living in Wigan. Skem isn't far from Wigan, but every day the bus felt like it was crossing some kind of border post when it went through Up Holland. You could see the fashions change. You could hear the accent mutate so that it was a buzz on one street and a bus by the next. But I never got beaten up for being a wool. I just got gently teased by dope-smoking lads into Pink Floyd or cute girls in white fringe boots. In other places, though, the tectonic plates of this very northern schism rub up against each other with a great deal more edge and friction. Highton and St Helens are 5 minutes' drive away from each other, but here the fault line between Scouser and Woollyback is a crackling seam of animosity among the population, particularly the younger end. Essentially, they fucking hate each other, la. It gets really complicated here because a new social group enters the already heady mix, the Plastic Scouser. Plazzy has been a term of abuse amongst Liverpudlians since the 60s, when local movers and shakers like Alan Williams, the manager who gave away the Beatles, see really stupid Scousers, used it to describe those people who talked up their Scouseness, laying on the fab gear whack stuff with a trowel, but who were off to Surrey at the first chance they got, such as Cilla Black or, let's face it, the Beatles themselves. But then it starts to mean someone who lives on the Wirral Peninsula, particularly Birkenhead or Wallasey, who sound towards Woollybacks like a Scouser, but is in fact a softy fellow traveller. And these days, Plazzy has a third meaning, drenched in spittle and loathing. A plastic Scouser is what the real Scouser and the Woollyback alike. There will be a handout and a chance to ask questions at the end, by the way. Call one of those despised breed of chav scallies from the West Lancashire towns like Highton and Rainhill. They are a distinctive tribe, identifiable for their penchant for Rockport, Henry Lloyd and Lacoste brands, and for the stylistic quirk of wearing their tracksuit bottoms, trackies, tucked into their socks. This looks just as cataclysmically shit as it sounds, but hang around Highton bus station and you will see scores of weasel-faced youths dressed like this, pallid from lack of vitamin C, generally looking for something to urinate on or set fire to. Plastic Scousers of this ilk have no interest in being witty, vital or revolutionising popular music, but merely in being thought of as hard or criminal and not nesh or soft. They are the sort of lads who, when seen from a distance or singly, are kind of ridiculous, even pathetic, but who look very different when they converge in a quintet on your bus stop at 11:30 at night and ask you the time. In 2005, a young black student called Anthony Walker found himself in the wrong part of Highton with the wrong kind of Scousers, and his murder appalled the country. All of this geopolitical analysis and ethnic labelling is simply to illustrate what all Merseysiders have known all along, that Scousers are different. They are the Basques of Lancashire, a race apart, with a language and culture that seems to bear no relation to any of the people around them. When J.B. Priestley undertook his famous tour of England in the 1930s for his book English Journey, he never thought for a second not to place Liverpool stolidly in Lancashire. Glance briefly at J.B.'s chapter titles, and at first you might think he's missed the whole city out. In fact, it's the very first place he visits at the beginning of the chapter, in Lancashire, and he ends up, after a day mired in the city's then endemic poverty and squalor, dining alone and thoughtfully smoking a good cigar in the restaurant of the Adelphi Hotel. But never for a moment does he think that the city is anything other than Lancastrian. That notion seems faintly bizarre now, not just because Scousers relish their outsider status, but because we have become so comfortable with the idea of Merseyside. It may be the only one of those newfangled 70s appellations that has actually caught hold and come to mean anything. The reason, as far as I can see, must be because rather than make a nonsense of local kinships and ties, like putting Wigan in some abstraction like Greater Manchester, or the Old Man of Coniston in Cumbria, or Hull in Cleveland, rather than putting local noses out of joint, it actually confirms what those locals have believed all the time. That they are different, separate, sovereign. Merseyside was created, entirely seriously we should point out, on the 1st of April 1974, from bits annexed from the counties of Lancashire and Cheshire, along with the county boroughs of Birkenhead, Wallasey, Liverpool, Bootle and St Helens. The Tories were never very happy about the concept of Merseyside. It embodied everything they feared and distrusted about big Soviet-style 70s socialism in the region. Men with northern accents sitting behind big desks in massive new civic centres, drinking keg bitter and calling each other comrade. In 1986, Thatcher abolished the county council. Bet she had a whiskey or two that night, although it still exists legally and as a ceremonial county. But everyone still refers to it and still uses the term. It is that curiosity, a piece of governmental jargon and red tape that ordinary people have taken to their heart. So much so that when Liverpool played Everton in the FA Cup final of 1986, the fans of those two fierce and historic rivals sang Merseyside, Merseyside in unison. This was their chance, at the high point of the city's demonisation as Britain's capital of crime and corruption, to wave a cheery two fingers to London and the world. Of course, others would see it as yet more evidence of the city's mawkish sentimentality. In October 2004, Boris Johnson, the likeable, buffoonish right-wing media personality, wrote a Spectator editorial in the wake of the horrific murder by beheading of Ken Bigley, a British hostage in Iraq. It was a fairly sober article in general, bemoaning the fact that since Princess Diana's death, we have become a nation of crybabies. But one thread of Johnson's arguments provoked an outpouring of red, red rage. The extreme reaction to Mr. Bigley's murder is fed by the fact that he was a Liverpudlian. They see themselves whenever possible as victims and resent their victim status, yet at the same time they wallow in it. Part of this flawed psychological state is that they cannot accept that they might have made any contribution to their misfortunes, but seek rather to blame someone else for it. He goes on to quote Captain Scott's last journals and to bemoan the disappearance of the British buccaneer, etc., etc. But the hot stuff is right there in that paragraph above. A petrol bomb lobbed from the reading room of the Athenaeum Club and scoring a direct hit on the streets of Toxteth. In the vernacular of the North, it all kicked off. Bigley's brother Paul denounced Johnson as a pompous twit who should get out of public life. The then Tory leader Michael Howard denounced the article as nonsense and demanded that Johnson, up till then a rising star of the Tory party, go round and apologise, like a schoolboy who's put his neighbour's window through with a stray football. Johnson got a train to Lime Street and mooched about town looking sheepish and concerned, doubtless having health centres and renovated bus stops pointed out to him by local dignitaries. Ken Bigley was held hostage for 3 weeks before he was killed, an agonising sentence for his family, who had to endure occasional videotaped messages from him in captivity and the almost certain expectation of a dreadful outcome. During this time, Billy Connolly had cracked a joke on tour in London to the effect, "Ken Bigley, don't you just wish they'd get on with it?" There was a brief cappuccino froth of disapproval, but nothing more, no calls for an apology, no tearing up of contracts, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. Silly old Boris makes a reasonable point about sentimentality and victimhood and is forced into the political wilderness, for a while at least, in a sackcloth demob suit. LA-based multimillionaire comedian Billy savours Bigley's imminent murder for a laugh, and there's a mild tut. The difference is that though Connolly's remark was enormously more offensive, he had the good sense to leave Liverpool out of it. There was, in fact, nothing new about Johnson's article. Broadsheet journalists had been sneering and railing at the city, often much more vituperatively, for years. Days after the Hillsborough disaster, the Times printed a column by Edward Pearce arguing that the shrine in the Anfield Goalmouth, the cursing of the police, all the theatricals come sweetly to a city which is already the world capital of self-pity. There are soapy politicians to make a pet of Liverpool, and Liverpool itself is always standing by to make a pet of itself. Why us? Why are we treated like animals? To which the plain answer is that a good and sufficient minority of you behave like animals. Even Sir David Henshaw, the chief executive of Liverpool City Council, at a conference marketing Liverpool as the 2008 European City of Culture, complained that it can sometimes still be the most mind-bogglingly awful and whinging place where the glass is always half empty. And with friends like that, who needs Boris? The problem in the end might be that, as someone said to me soon after Ken Bigley's murder, it's always Liverpool, isn't it? From the Beatles to Bill Shankly, Ken Bigley to Jamie Bulger, Hillsborough to Hazel, Chirpy Comics to Inner City Riots, it's always Liverpool. The Icicle Works' Ian McNabb, one of the best songwriters the city has ever produced, got it just right in an anthemic track from the mid-1980s called Up Here in the North of England. McDonald's finally found us and were folklore in Turin. The Southerners don't like us. Who can blame them? Seems we're always in the spotlight. Liverpool got its charter in 1207 from King John, but was merely a sleepy fishing village until the fortuitous silting up of the Dee put Chester out of commission as a port. Liverpool grew rich out of both Chester and Africa's misfortunes. The first dock was built in 1705 to facilitate Liverpool's strategic importance in the slave trade, part of the triangle that linked Africa, the UK and America. That legacy is still contentious and difficult for sensitive Scousers. Liverpool's black community feel it partly as an open wound, partly as badge of identity. Some Liverpudlians feel it's a shameful episode to be hushed up, ammunition for those who criticise Liverpool's race relations. Both Everton and Liverpool football clubs, for instance, were extremely slow to incorporate black players. Others are more rueful. Over a pint in the Philharmonic, or Phil, one of the city's iconic boozers, a thoughtful middle-aged man from the Dingle explained to me, "We never had slavery, no. We just made the money from it." Daniel Defoe came in the 1720s and loved it, a town so populous and rich that it may be called the Bristol of this part of England. During the 19th century, it was the embarkation point for waves of migrations. Between 1830 and 1930, 1 million people left via Liverpool for the New World, the USA and Australia. Many more would-be emigrants never got further than the pierhead, staying in Liverpool to provide the cheap labour needed in the burgeoning port and giving it a vibrant, multi-ethnic stew that few other British cities could match. Carl Jung called it the pool of life, a gumbo of Irish refugees fleeing the potato famine, Caribbean families, Chinese sailors and laundrymen. When the Cavern started to ring to the sound of Merseybeat, Liverpool was still a burly, broad-shouldered, bustling port. But as the 60s began to swing, the pendulum swung away from Liverpool. Mass air travel pretty much put paid to the luxury liner business, and the ports of Kent and the South-East prospered as trade with Europe became our national priority. Liverpool found itself facing in the wrong direction. In the 70s, Liverpool became a caricature, city of tashes, perms, robbery and signing on. Sporadically, the city immolated itself in rioting, revelling in its own demise. They should build a fence around Liverpool and charge admission, for, sadly, it has become a showcase of everything that's gone wrong in Britain's big cities, claimed a Daily Mirror editorial of 1982. Perhaps the blackest irony of all is that the city's one success story of the era, Liverpool FC's dominance of Europe, ended in tragedy at Hazel and Hillsborough. The Rough Guide to England begins its section on Liverpool thus. If one city in England could be said to stand for a nation in decline, it could be Liverpool. That seems a bit strong to me, especially if, having detrained at Lime Street Station, you are taking in the view from the station's steps. From here, even on a raw, filthy winter's morning, looking out across the pedestrian crossings to the St. George's Hall, you get almost knocked down by a wave of sheer civic machismo from a century and a half ago. It's a hell of a building. Imagine if the Parthenon had stopped fannying about sunbathing in Athens, done a day's work, got itself a manly patina of grime, and then landed in the middle of Liverpool. The fact that it's the first thing you see when you exit Lime Street Station is no accident. Back in the 1850s when it was built, this was Liverpool's swaggering announcement to the world that it had arrived, that a Lancastrian backwater